Nathanael, Chapter 36. Nathanael's fury at the failure of his swoop knew no bounds. He returned to Whitehall in a vicious temper, urging his chauffeur to ever greater speeds and beating the leather seat with his fist at any mild delay. He dismissed the car outside internal affairs, and despite the lateness of the hour, stomped across the courtyard to his office. Here he snapped on the lights, threw himself into his chair, and began to think. He had badly miscalculated, and the fact that he had been so close to success made his failure all the more galling. He had been absolutely right to check the public records in search of Kathleen Jones's name. He'd uncovered the typescript of her trial, together with her home address, in less than an hour. He'd been right to visit the parents, too. They were malleable fools, both of them. And his original plan, to get them to detain their daughter should she return home, whilst secretly informing him, would have worked out perfectly had the girl not arrived back earlier than expected. Yet even that would have been fine, had she not unexpectedly displayed some kind of personal defence against the minor demons. Perplexing. The parallels with the mercenary were obvious, of course. The real question was whether their powers were their own, or the product of some spell. His senses had not detected anything. If Bartimaeus had been with him, it might have shed some light on the source of the girl's power, and perhaps prevented her escape. It was a great pity that Jinny was on the other mission. Nathanael regarded his jacket sleeve, now permanently marked with remnants of the moolah. He muttered a curse. Conceited small-timer! It was hard not to admire the girl's strength of character. Nevertheless, Kitty Jones would pay dearly for that insult. Alongside his anger, he was uneasy, too. He could, with great simplicity, have requested police backup, or asked Whitwell to provide vigilant sphere surveillance of the parents' house. But he had not done so. He had wanted the success for himself and himself alone. Retrieving the staff would have enhanced his status immeasurably. The Prime Minister would have lauded him to the skies. Perhaps he would have been promoted, allowed to explore the powers of the staff. Duval and Whitwell would have been left looking uncomfortably over their shoulders. But the girl had got away, and should anyone learn about his failure, he would be held to account. The death of Tallow had left his colleagues prickly, agitated, and even more paranoid than normal. It was not a good time to be found out. He had to locate the girl, and quickly. At that moment, a ringing in his ear warned him of an approaching magic. He stood alert, and an instant later saw Bartimaeus materializing in the midst of a blue cloud. It wore its gargoyle form. Nathanael rubbed his eyes and composed himself. "Well, you have something to report? Lovely to see you, too." The gargoyle reached down, plumped the cloud into the shape of a cushion, and sat with a sigh. "Yep. Veni vidi vici, and all that. The Afreet is no more. I'm knackered, though not possibly as much as you. You look dreadful. You disposed of the demon?" Nathanael perked up. This was good news. It would count for much with Devereux. "Sure did. Drowned him in the Thames. Word is already spreading. And by the way, you were right. It was that Kitty who nicked the staff. Have you caught her yet?" "No. Well, better stop making faces and get busy tracking her down." "Hey!" The gargoyle peered closer. "You've got a bruise on your cheek. Someone's been fighting."
"No, I haven't. It's not important."
"Scrapping like a street kid? Was it ever a girl? A matter of honour? Come on. You can tell me."
"Just forget about it. Listen, I am pleased at your success. Now we must locate the girl."
Nathanael prodded the bruise gingerly with a finger. It smarted. The gargoyle sighed. "Easier said than done. Where, pray, do I start?"
"I don't know. I need to think.
For the moment, you are dismissed. I'll summon you again in the morning."
"Very well."
Gargoyle and cloud drifted backwards into the wall and vanished. When all was still once more, Nathanael stood beside his desk, deep in thought. Night pressed up against the office window. There was no sound from the street outside. He was very weary. his body cried out for its bed. But the staff was too important to be lost so easily. Somehow he must trace it. Perhaps a reference book might. Nathaniel was brought up short by a sudden knocking on the courtyard door. He listened, heart hammering in his chest. Another three knocks, gentle but assertive. Who would be calling at this hour? Visions of the terrible mercenary sprang into his mind. He shrugged them away, squared his shoulders, and approached the door. Moistening his lips, he turned the handle and swung the door aside. A short, roundish gentleman stood upon the step, blinking in the light that spilled out from the office. He was dressed in a flamboyant green velvet suit, white spats, and a mauve travelling coat fastened at his neck. On his head was a small suede hat. He beamed at Nathaniel's discomfiture.
"Hello, Mandrake, my boy. May I come in? It's Parky out."
"Mr. Makepeace? Yes. Please come in, sir."
"Thank you, my boy, thank you."
With a hop and a skip, Mr. Quentin Makepeace was inside. He took off his hat and tossed it across the room, to land with great precision upon a bust of Gladstone. He winked at Nathaniel.
"We've had enough of him, one way and another, I think."
Chuckling at his little joke, Mr. Makepeace wedged himself into a chair.
"This is an unexpected honour, sir."
Nathaniel hovered uncertainly.
"Can I get you anything?"
"No, no, Mandrake. Sit down, sit down. I've just popped in for a little chat."
He smiled broadly at Nathaniel.
"I hope I have not disturbed you in your work."
"Certainly not, sir. I was just thinking of heading home."
"Very good, too. Sleep is so vital, and yet so hard to come by, as the Sultan says in the bathhouse scene. That's Act Two, Scene Three of My Love's an Eastern Maid, of course. Did you see it?"
"I'm afraid not, sir. I was too young. My previous master, Mr. Underwood, did not attend the theatre as a rule."
"Ah, a crying shame."
Mr. Makepeace shook his head sadly.
"With an education as defective as that, it's a wonder you've turned out such a promising lad."
"I've seen Swans of Araby, of course, sir," Nathaniel said hastily. "A wonderful work. Very moving."
It has been called my masterpiece by several critics, but I trust I shall outdo it with my next little effort. I have been inspired by the American troubles and turned my attention to the West, a dark continent we know so little about, Mandrake. My working title is Petticoats and Rifles. It involves a young backwoods lass."
As he was speaking, Mr. Makepeace made several intricate signs with his hands. From between his palms rose a scattering of orange sparks that floated up and outwards to take up position at points about the room. No sooner were they stationary than the playwright stopped talking in mid-sentence and winked at Nathaniel.
"See what I've done, boy?"
"A sensor web, sir, to detect watching ears or eyes."
"Exactly so. And all, for the moment, is quiet. Now then, I didn't come to talk to you about my oeuvre, fascinating though it is. I wanted to sound you out, you being a promising lad, about a certain proposition."
"I would be honoured to hear it, sir."
"It goes without saying, of course," Mr. Makepeace said, "that the contents of this little talk will be for us alone. It could do us both great harm if a word of it were breathed beyond these four walls. You have a reputation for being just as intelligent as you are young and spry, Mandrake. I am sure that you understand."
"Of course, sir."
Nathaniel composed his features into a mask of polite attention. Beneath this, he was perplexed, if flattered. Why the playwright had now accosted him in such secrecy, Nathaniel could not imagine. Mr. Makepeace's close friendship with the Prime Minister was widely spoken of, but Nathaniel had never thought that the author was much of a magician himself. In fact, on the basis of viewing a couple of the plays, he had considered it unlikely. Privately, Nathaniel considered them appalling potboilers.
"First, congratulations are in order," Mr. Makepeace said. "The renegade Afreet is gone, and I believe your jinni played a part in its removal. Well done. You may be sure the PM has taken notice. It is, in fact, on account of this that I have come to you this evening. Someone of your efficiency may be able to help me in a tricky problem." He paused, but Nathaniel said nothing. It was best to be cautious when confiding in a stranger. Makepeace's objectives were not yet clear. "You were at the Abbey this morning," Mr. Makepeace went on, "and you listened to the debate among the council. It would not have escaped your notice that our friend, the police chief, Mr. Duval, has attained great influence."
"Yes, sir."
"As commander of the Greybacks, he has long been in a position of considerable power, and he makes no secret of his desire to gain more. He has already used the current disturbances to gain authority at the expense of your master, Ms. Whitwell."
"I've noticed some such rivalry," Nathaniel said. He did not think it prudent to say more.
"Very carefully put, Mandrake. Now, as a personal friend of Rupert Devereux, I don't mind telling you that I've been viewing Duval's behaviour with a good deal of concern. Ambitious men are dangerous, Mandrake. They destabilize things. Boorish, uncivilized individuals such as Duval— it will shock you to learn he has never attended one of my premiers in his life— are the worst of all, since they have no respect for their colleagues. Duval has been building up his power base for years, keeping in with the PM, while undermining other senior figures at the same time. His vaunting ambition has long been obvious. Recent events, such as the unfortunate demise of our friend Tallow, have greatly unsettled our senior ministers, and this perhaps gives Duval further opportunity to take advantage. In fact, and I don't mind telling you this, Mandrake, since you're so uncommonly clever and loyal, with the amount of power Duval now has, I fear a rebellion. Perhaps because of his background in theatre, Mr. Makepeace had a peculiarly lively way of talking. His voice fluted high and tremulous, then dived to become low and resonating. Despite his caution, Nathaniel was fascinated. He leaned in closer.
"Yes, my boy, you heard correctly. Rebellion is what I fear. And as Mr. Devereux's most loyal friend, I am anxious to prevent it. I am looking for allies in this regard. Jessica Whitwell is powerful, of course, but we do not get on. She is no great lover of the theatre. But you, Mandrake, you are rather more my type. I've followed your career for quite some time, ever since that unfortunate Lovelace affair, in fact, and I think we might do admirably well together."
"That is very kind of you, sir," Nathaniel said slowly. His mind was afire. This was what he'd been waiting for. A direct line to the Prime Minister.
Ms. Whitwell was no true ally. She'd already made it clear that she planned to sacrifice his career. Well, if he played this carefully, he might gain rapid advancement. Perhaps he didn't need her protection after all. But this was dangerous territory. He had to be on his guard.
"Mr. Duval is a formidable opponent," he said blandly. "It is a dangerous thing to act against him."
Mr. Makepeace smiled.
"How very true. But haven't you already been doing something along those lines? I believe you paid a visit to the Public Records Office this afternoon, and then set off at speed to an obscure address in Balham." The words were casual, but they made Nathaniel stiffen with shock.
"Forgive me," he stammered. "How did you know?"
"Word reaches me about many things, my boy. As a friend of Mr. Devereux, I have long kept my eyes and ears open. Do not look so worried. I have no idea what you are up to, merely that it seemed a personal initiative."
His smile broadened. "Duval is in charge of counter-revolutionary tactics now, but I don't think you informed him of your activities."
Nathaniel certainly had not. His head reeled. He needed to gain time.
You mentioned us collaborating in some way, sir," he said. "What do you have in mind?"
Quentin Makepeace settled back into his chair. "Gladstone's staff," he said. "That's it.
pure and simple. The Afreet has been dealt with, and much of the resistance is dead too, it seems. All well and good. But the staff is a potent talisman. It confers great power on its bearer. I can tell you that as we speak, Mr. Duval is applying all his efforts to find the person who took it. Should he do so, the magician fixed Nathaniel directly with his bright blue eyes, he might decide to use it himself, rather than restore it to the government. I believe the situation is as serious as that. Much of London might be threatened.
"Yes, sir," Nathaniel said. "I have read about the staff, and I believe its energies can be easily accessed by a few simple incantations. Duval might well use it."
"Indeed. And I think we should preempt him. If you find the staff and return it to Mr. Devereux yourself, your standing will be greatly enhanced, and Mr. Duval will have suffered a setback. I will be content, too, since the Prime Minister will continue to help finance my works worldwide. What do you think of this proposal?"
Nathaniel's head was awhirl. "An interesting plan, sir."
"Good, good. So we are agreed. We must act swiftly." Mr. Makepeace leaned forward and clapped Nathaniel on the shoulder. Nathaniel blinked. In his comradely enthusiasm, Makepeace was taking his acceptance entirely for granted. The proposal was beguiling, of course, but he felt uncertain, outmanoeuvred. He needed a moment to work out what to do. Yet he had no time. The magician's knowledge of his activities had caught him horribly off guard, and he was no longer in control. Nathaniel made a reluctant decision. If Makepeace knew of his visit to Balham, there was no point concealing it anyway.
"I have already conducted some investigations," he said stiffly, "and I believe the staff might be in the hands of a girl, one Kitty Jones."
The magician nodded approvingly. "I can see my high opinion of you was correct, Mandrake. Any idea where she might be?"
"I nearly caught her at her parents' house this evening, sir. I missed her by minutes. I don't believe she had the staff on her at the time."
Mr. Makepeace scratched his chin. He made no attempt to cross-examine Nathaniel on the details. "And now she will have fled. She will be hard to trace, unless we can encourage her out of hiding. Did you arrest the parents? A few well-publicized tortures might draw the girl out."
"No, sir. I did consider it, but they were not close to her. I do not believe that she would give herself up for them."
"Even so, it is an option. But I have another possible idea, Mandrake. I have a contact who has one foot in London's murky underworld. He is acquainted with more beggars, thieves, and cut-purses than you could cram into a theatre. I shall talk to him tonight, see if he can give us word on this Kitty Jones. With a bit of luck, we shall be able to act tomorrow. In the meantime, I suggest you go home to get some sleep. And remember, we are playing for high stakes, my boy. And Mr. Duval is a dangerous rival. Not a word of our little agreement to anyone."